How you doing, everybody? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. Friday morning, Fly Jams Friday, coming up straight out of context. Nick D Show Spies, You Big Dummy, all the regular Friday features. And we're also going to talk about people who are turning 50 this year. Lots of famous people and celebrities are turning 50 this year, and we'll talk about those people and some of the things we love about them and how old we start feeling when people start turning 50. So that's all coming up. Right now, though, I want to welcome back to the show Rod Pyle. He's an award-winning writer, speaker, filmmaker on the topic of space. He hosts Cool Space News Podcast. He recently was named the editor of Ad Astra Magazine, and he's written several great books. You can check out pylebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com, for more information. And, of course, we have a link on our Facebook page. Lots of big space news to talk about since the last time we talked to Rod, and let's welcome Rod to the show. Rod, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, sir, and I want to turn 50 again.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, it's back there a little ways.
Yeah, I was.
It would be kind of fun.
I'm about 3 years back. I turned 53 this year,
child.
Yeah. Well, Rod, welcome back, everybody, and lots
Thank
of.
You.
I mean, so obviously, we've got one major, awesome, cool as hell story to talk about,
yeah.
And much more. But by way of introduction, for those people, tell everybody your background and how you got into all that space stuff and all that cool stuff.
Well, because I'm an old man, I was able to grow up during the Apollo years. So I was born in 56. I remember some of the Gemini flights, but really Apollo was when I kind of woke up to it. And it was kind of interesting. I'm working on an Apollo book, and I was interviewing Buzz Aldrin's kid the other day, Andy Aldrin. We were talking about growing up during the space race, and he's like a year and a half younger than me. And I said, you know, I'm sure it seemed normal to you to live around all the astronauts and do all this cool stuff in Houston when you were growing up. But what were your passions? He said, football. I thought space was weird, and I thought, man, we grew up in the wrong household, you and me, pal. But he's a very nice guy, told some great stories. So anyway, I grew up during the space race, saw that stuff, thought that was amazing. Then, you know, went through college like everybody else and wanted to be a scientist and discovered that science and I didn't get along as well as I thought. So I did struggle through and finish a couple of programs, but I ended up in the media. And after years of reality TV, thought, I want to tell real stories. This kind of blows, and that's how I got into the book business, and I've been doing that ever since. So
Very cool.
I think this year is number 13.
There you go. Before we jump into some of the other stuff, congratulations on being named editor of Ad Astra Magazine. Tell everybody about
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that's published by the National Space Society, and I've flogged them on here before.
Yeah.
They were founded in the 70s by Wernher von Braun himself. And have been going on ever since. So I've been a member off and on for like 35 years, but I hadn't really gotten that engaged. But there was a slot came open to help on the magazine, so I jumped in. And recently, as you were kind enough to mention, became editor. So I get to either make it great or mess it up, but I think I'll make it great. And it's already really, really good. And it comes out four times a year, and you get it if you become a member of the society.
And what is it?
My website and all that.
What does it cover, Ad Astra?
Well, you know, it's trying to the National Space Society's thing has always been we want to include everybody. You know, we want everything from NASA executives and scientists and leaders and engineers down to grassroots folks who just care and are interested in this because everybody's got to have a conversation about why space matters and why we should go and what we're doing up there and why it's important and all that. So that's really the general sort of seed of the group. They do a lot of stuff. They talk to government. They wrote a report that got on Trump's desk during the transition. So they're able to operate at those high levels. But they also hold a convention every year called the International Space Development Conference. It's in L.A. this year, and that's in May. And it's a chance for 1,000, 1,200 people to get together and listen to talks and see movies and mingle and rub shoulders with really important people. So that's a big part of what we talk about in the magazine, too, is all those activities.
All right, very cool. All the information is at your website, and we have a link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow.
Thank you.
All right, Rod, the Falcon Heavy.
Oh man!
as soon as you know the watching all the stuff online and looking at it, all I kept thinking about was how you were reacting to it. I swear to God, it was like God. Rod must be losing his mind right now. First of all, for people who might not know, talk about the Falcon Heavy, and then we can talk about that launch and everything.
So February 6th, Falcon Heavy took off after a fairly short hold. It was a two-hour hold for weather. And, you know, having watched rocket launches both in person and on television for years, I thought, oh, they'll, you know, delay a day and then another day and then a week and all that. But I'd forgotten to remind myself that this rocket didn't have people on it, so the holds are a little less critical than they would be for if you're launching human beings.
Right.
So it took off February 6th. Flawless test flight of Elon Musk's newest rocket. And this was something he thought of in 2004, a couple of years after he started SpaceX. He wanted to build small rockets to test, then he wanted to build bigger ones to enter the space business, and against all odds succeeded in that. So that's the Falcon 9, which is a 9-engine rocket. And he said, you know, I want to build something really big so we can start doing impressive stuff in space. So he took three of his Falcon 9s and clustered them together, thought, how hard can it be? It's been done before. And that effectively tripled the amount of thrust it puts out, and it can lift really heavy payloads. It turned out to be a little harder than he thought, so instead of a date of 2013, which he had planned, it took until 2018 for a whole bunch of reasons. But it did its thing, so we are now flying, hopefully with consistent success. It'll be a few months before another one goes up, but this is the most powerful rocket, most powerful U.S. rocket since the Saturn V, which last flew in 1973, and the most powerful rocket in the world since the Soviets had one called Energia that flew back in the 80s. So it's able to lift a lot of weight for a lot less than the competition. The only other rocket that's even close is by a company called the United Launch Alliance. That's a Delta Heavy. It can launch, I think, 50,000 pounds for about $400,000. And the Falcon Heavy can launch about 2.5 times that for $90 million.
Wow.
And that's a bargain in this business.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so the launch went off basically without a hitch, right? I mean, it went off so well, it was shocking, correct?
It was, and so it went up, and the two side boosters came off, and we were a little worried about that because, for some reason, Elon Musk doesn't like pyrotechnics, which are the little explosive squibs that they use to separate stages and side boosters on rockets.
Right.
Ever since NASA started doing this, you have little bombs, essentially, that go bang-bang, and the side boosters or the stages come off. Musk said, no, I want to use nitrogen plungers and little gas rockets to do it instead. And a lot of engineers kind of went, you sure? You know, everything else you're kind of inventing ground up. Are you sure you don't want to just go with the tried and true? And he said, nope. So there was some concern that they wouldn't separate properly, but as you saw, they did perfectly. It went up and deployed its payload, famously, a red Tesla Roadster, his personal red Tesla Roadster.
Right.
And then, to my undying shock, those two side boosters actually both flew back and landed, not just the same time and in the same place that they departed from, a quarter mile, a couple miles away, but just like the animation he had put up a year before. Somebody did pull frames from the animation of the video of the actual flyback, and really the only difference was the texture of the clouds in the background. I mean, they looked exactly
identical. Wow.
Which was stunning. So the only thing that didn't work, as hoped, was the central booster core, which goes higher and goes a lot faster, flew back down and lost video right towards the end of its return. And it was trying to land on the barge that they use from time to time out in the ocean because it's obviously further offshore once it comes back.
Right.
And it apparently they ran out of the juice that they used to reignite the engine, and not all the engines reignited, so it hit the water at about 300 miles an hour and apparently damaged the barge a little bit, but nothing serious.
And this footage that came back, Rod, of the car and everything, it's like the coolest. Yeah. It was unbelievably cool. I mean, that was just so, and it captured everybody's imagination. Like social media and television were all over it, and it was the first sort of high profile sort of space thing that everybody was like, and even people who aren't interested in the space program or space in general. Everybody was fascinated and completely hypnotized by this.
Yeah, and I don't want to gush like too much of a fanboy, but this man is brilliant and deserves every bit of the Tony Stark reputation that he's got, except for the Playboy part. I mean, as he explained in a couple of tweets, so that people mostly know this, you have to put something on the nose of the rocket during a test. You have to put some mass up there to balance it and make sure that it can actually lift heavy things.
Yeah.
So you either put out some sand or a block of metal or a tank of water, something heavy and large enough to make that up. And he said, well, that's boring. I'll launch my car. It's good for Tesla. It's good for SpaceX. And it makes us look cool and engaging. And he was fairly certain that there was about a 50-50 chance of success or failure on this flight, he kept saying. It got a little higher later, but he was really not at all convinced it was going to work out because there's so many new technologies at work here. Even though they're building on the heritage of the space race in the U.S. and Russia,
Yeah. There's
a whole lot of stuff that's new about his rocket. So the chances it would work, to him, were about half and half. And if you saw that National Geographic footage of him running outside after the launch, just gobsmacked that this was working. And then this footage coming back, as you said, this 12 hours of footage from the Roadster was just galvanizing. And I think besides being a brilliant PR move, if you're a kid growing up in India or Southeast Asia or Eastern Europe or somewhere, and you've heard about this stuff, but you don't have a lot of exposure to it because it's not happening in your part of your country, and you see this, this is a magic moment, almost like watching the first moonwalk.
Oh, yeah.
This amazing, cool thing,
Yeah. Especially
with that mannequin with his left arm draped over the door, right? I mean, that just for me, that really did it.
Yeah, that put it over the top, man. It really did. It was an amazing achievement. And what's it been like, you know, among all of you space geeks? You guys just must have been in heaven.
We were. I actually stayed in my home office to watch it. I was going to go join a bunch of people, and I thought, you know, this is going to be one of those Apollo moments for me, and I just want to enjoy it quietly in a corner with a beer and maybe a dewy eye or two. And it was early, but I did for both, and it was sensational. And so, you know, in talking to peers about it, it's really hard to overreact. I mean, this is such a game changer.
Yeah.
Lori Garver, who was the deputy administrator of NASA under Obama and Charlie Bolden, since she left the agency, she's been fairly critical of
there. And hold on a second, Rod, because I want to talk about her response, her op-ed about that. And I definitely want to talk about, you know, obviously you just said it was a game changer. I want to talk about how this is going to impact NASA and the future and all that cool stuff. Okay, hang on a second.
Okay.
Rod Pyle is with us, and we are talking about space, in particular the Falcon Heavy launch, which was an unbelievable, unqualified success and cool as hell. And if you have any questions about space or any of that kind of stuff, or comments about it, about the Falcon Heavy and all that cool stuff, text us or call us. Rod Pyle is here, 312-981-7200. News is next. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, overlooking beautiful Michigan Avenue. It's Friday morning. That means Fly Jams Friday is back. You might want to get your requests in, 312-981-7200. We'll celebrate and talk about great R&B and listen to it as well. That'll be later in the show. The Friday regular features, we've got You Big Dummy coming up straight out of context, Nick D Show Spies, and we're also going to talk about celebrities and famous people who are turning 50 this year so that we can all feel old. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is talk and text. And by the way, if you have any questions or comments about space or any questions about that or the Falcon Heavy launch that was so cool that happened a couple of weeks ago, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 because Rod Pyle is with us. He's an award-winning writer, speaker, and on the topic of space, he's written a bunch of really cool books. He hosts Cool Space News Podcast, and he was just named Ad Astra Magazine Editor. And you can check out pylebooks.com. That's pylebooks.com. And we have a link for all of that stuff on our Facebook page. And let's get back to our conversation with Rod. Rod, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right. So we talked about how great and how successful the Falcon Heavy launch is, was, and how cool, just how damn cool it was. You were mentioning Lori Garver before the break, and
Lori Garver,
she was
the deputy administrator under the Obama administration. And usually, when you're part of that NASA club, you know, you may come out occasionally and say things contrary to the general conversation, but most of them kind of toe the line. You know, they don't really go up against the big organization. And she put this op-ed out on The Hill, which is a publication all about what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Mm.
called Falcon Heavy Could Save NASA in the Future of Space Exploration, and basically saying, can we please stop spending money on this big, expensive government rocket project, the SLS, because for every flight of that, you can fly 10 Falcon Heavies, or probably 8 of the new rocket they're going to succeed it with in a few years, the BFR. We've already talked about what that stands for, the big Falcon rocket, quote-unquote,
right.
Falcon.
Right.
And, you know, he's going to build out, Musk says he's going to build out the Falcon Heavy in a handful of years, probably not bother human rating it, because he feels that the progress on the BFR is going so well, which is much larger and much more cost-effective to fly, because it's completely reusable. Literally, everything goes up and everything comes back, that... you know, she thought that that's probably the way to go and stop spending all this money on what she calls a jobs program. So it's about $3 billion a year of NASA's $19 billion budget, which doesn't sound like a huge amount, but over 10 years, it adds up.
Yeah.
And when it costs between, depending on how you do the math, between $1 billion to a few billion for every flight, even though it's kind of NASA's flagship, okay, but we're going to use this for deep space exploration, you can fly people on it, it's just tough to keep rationalizing how that's a good thing when you've got these private people coming in. And we haven't even talked about Jeff Bezos and his big rocket that's coming up. So it's going to be a really interesting thing to watch over the next couple of years.
And what the difference is kind of staggering in terms of how much it costs.
Yeah, and some of that's the other problem with the SLS is that none of it's reusable. So it's basically kind of a Saturn V on steroids, as it's been called. It's newer than that, but it's not newer enough when you look at what SpaceX and Blue Origin are doing.
And how has NASA reacted to the success of the launch?
They applauded it. They were tepidly enthusiastic, I guess would be a good way to put it. They did a study about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, an internal study to see how much it would have cost them to develop the Falcon 9. And they said, you know, it's anywhere from 50 to 90% more, many times a multiple. So they feel, even they are saying that SpaceX has done it much, much cheaper than they could ever do it, given the processes that they use and the distributed manufacturing centers in different states, because you got to keep, you know, the congressmen and senators happy and so forth. So it's not that NASA can't do wonderful things. They are definitely still the premier space agency in the world, in my opinion, and are still leaders in exploration and science. But when it comes to just building the hardware and doing it efficiently and flying it efficiently to get things up to orbit and maybe out to the moon and back, it looks like private industry is giving a real run for their money. And in a perfect world, that's a great partnership if you do it right.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
So that's how they've done everything else. I mean, the government doesn't fly airplanes back and forth from Chicago to L.A. anymore. Private industry does it because they're efficient and they do it inexpensively.
Right. Yeah. All right. You mentioned Bezos. What's up? What's up next for him?
That's interesting. They're harder to get info out of than SpaceX, as I think I've whined about a couple of times your show. Excuse me. And they have flown their new Shepard vehicle, I think, 6 times now. Perfectly. It's a small suborbital rocket, and they're testing their engines and their capsule, which is a tourist carrying device, but it can also go into orbit if needed with crew. And they haven't entered the sweepstakes to try and get the contracts from NASA to go up into the space station back like SpaceX and Boeing have, but they are building a larger rocket to service generally the same part of the trade that the Falcon Heavy would, called the New Glenn. And it's a slightly different design. It's a single big cylinder instead of 3 fuselages and so forth. Their payload capability isn't that far apart. It's just, it hasn't happened yet. So we're all kind of waiting because we all read that Bezos is selling $1 billion a year of his own stock, which he can afford, being the richest guy on the planet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But he's getting that money every year and pumping it into Blue Origin to build this rocket and complete this project. And we just haven't seen much out of it yet. But I suspect if we get into the plant, we'd see quite a bit. So in the next year and a half to 2.5 years, I think we'll see an early version of that fly. And that'll be great.
Because okay.
Then we know we've really arrived and it's a whole new space age again.
There we go. All right, back to SpaceX again. Explain what the SpaceX's catcher's mitt is to everybody.
This is really something.
Yeah.
So, let me just back up one quick step. I
sure.
was over at the factory about a year ago on a tour, and I'm looking at these interstage, or maybe it was a second stage fuselage. And normally when you build a rocket, to lighten these things, you cast out a metal, and then you take a router and you do little triangles through the whole thing. And it takes thousands of hours, but it lightens it and leaves it very strong. But it's incredibly labor intensive.
Yeah.
So I see somebody up there with a steel grinder, a sander, grinding big ovals on the side of the rocket. And I said, is that how you guys thin it out to lighten it up? She said, yeah. And I thought, it looks very Soviet, but it works, right? It's very practical. So they're all about practicality. Well, do the trick. Well, Musk wants to get the nose cones back. They're called fairings. It's the nose cone at the top. When you get into space, it splits into two pieces and normally is just dumped, either re-enters or drifts off, and the satellite goes its way, and that's the end of the flight. He said, you know, those things are about $5 million a set, so I'd like to get them back. So he added little maneuvering thrusters on them, and he put a navigational unit, an autonomous navigational unit, similar to what's on the Falcon 9. So just like those rockets fly back and land, now these fairings are going to come back in two pieces. They're going to glide as well as they can. They're kind of light and unwieldy, but they'll glide in, and a big parachute opens up. And to get them, I thought he'd land them in the water, just retrieve them. But he said, nah, water messes those things up. There's a better way. So I was down in San Pedro, which is the harbor area of Los Angeles, and saw this ship with these four claws on the back. It looked like it had a dead cockroach in the back with its legs spread out. What the heck is that? And it said Mr. Steven on the side. I thought, what the heck is that? But it was at the SpaceX dock, so I was curious. So it turns out they strung a big net on that, and when they flew Thursday morning, they sent this boat out, and it could do about 40 miles an hour over the water, to try and chase down and catch one of the fairings as an experiment. And if that worked, then they'd have two boats and two nets. And it's just like somebody missing the grip on a trapeze, and off they go, and they bounce the net a few times, and down they come. So that's what he's doing.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, this guy is...
It's crazy cool, though, right?
No, I know. It's absolutely awesome. I mean, here's another little detail that I absolutely love, is that you said it was called Mr. Steven.
Yeah.
And he named it after, from the novel, The Fault in Our Stars, which I just find, for some reason, I find that unbelievably hilarious and awesome.
Well, and all his watercraft are named weird things.
Yeah.
You know, Of Course I Still Love You, and Just Read the Instructions, out of these various science fiction novels. And, of course, if you're the publisher of those novels, you're thrilled because you've gotten a whole new life on it.
Right.
It's been on backlist for 20 years, right? And I wanted to add, those fairings come back at 10 times the speed of sound at 62 miles altitude. So that's the trick he's pulling
out.
This isn't just from a few thousand feet up.
Wow.
Also, besides the main satellite they launched, which is this big Spanish Earth imaging satellite, they also deployed a couple of their experimental small satellites called Tintin-1 and Tintin-2. And these are two of the ultimately 4,000 or so that he plans to put in low orbit to give the entire planet high-speed broadband access by 2024.
He's something, man. This guy is, you know, does the everybody talks about like mad genius or mad scientist. I think that I think that applies to this guy.
It does, and he's apparently, I've met him from a distance but never spoken to him.
Yeah.
But he's very intense. I saw him with the people on the shop floor, and he, you know, he's just a regular guy. He's out there in a open-collar shirt, chit-chatting with the staff and so forth, but he believes in 60-hour weeks and hard work to get things done.
Yeah.
And it shows, you know?
Yeah.
But that's what it takes.
Well,
and when he decides to do something, he doesn't just sit back and rest on his money, he does it.
Yeah, wow. All right, we got a couple of texts that came in, Rod.
Sure.
In conjunction with what we were talking about, the Falcon Heavy, 773 area code has a very basic question. What's going to happen to that car that was sent up? Will it decay? Will it be crushed by forces? That kind of stuff.
They claim they didn't do a whole lot to prep it, just deflated the tires and took a few things out of it, took out most of the drivetrain. So from what I've read, and we only got video back for 12 hours, so we're not going to see it anymore except to track it by radar and stuff.
Right.
The general feeling is between the hot and cold in space, gets up to about, I think, 180, 200 degrees, gets down to about minus 250. So you're going to have, because it's tumbling, this continuous hot, cold cycle, and that ends up baking out the plastic and causing it to crack and shrink and all that. And then, of course, there's radiation out there, which will also tend to cause things to fade and get brittle and so forth. So eventually, over a long period of time, the soft plastic parts and the cloth parts will begin to drift off and fly away. There will be a little constellation of crud kind of flying around it because there's no reason for them to go anywhere, right? They just kind of sit and orbit the car.
Right.
And then over many, many hundreds or thousands of years, it'll other parts will begin to come apart. But the bulk of it will probably be around for many hundreds of thousands of years, maybe a million years, just kind of orbiting out between. It's not going in orbit around Mars. It's going out past Mars's orbital path and then coming back past the Earth's orbital path and going out again.
Yeah.
So it's in this big Earth-Mars solar orbit, which is really neat.
That's very cool. Okay. Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right. Rod Pyle is with us, an award-winning writer and speaker on the topic of space. He hosts the Cool Space News podcast. He's the editor of Ad Astra magazine. He's written a lot of very cool books about space. 312-981-7200 is Talk and Text. We'll come back with more with Rod right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. All the regular Friday features are coming up, and we're also going to talk about celebrities who are turning 50 this year. Rod Pyle is with us. He's an award-winning writer and speaker on the topic of space. He's written several cool books that are awesome. He hosts the Cool Space News podcast. Busy guy, and we have links on our Facebook page for all that stuff. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
We have another text question here. 815 area code asks, are things ready for James Webb Space Telescope launch?
What a timely question. I was at a talk the other night out at Northrop Grumman Aerospace, and afterwards we were getting ready to leave, and one of the engineers said, hey, you want to go see the Webb? I said, the Webb? Oh, so we got to go take a look at it.
Uh-huh.
Huge. And it's sitting in their clean room now getting ready to go. So it's been delayed a number of times. It's way over budget. It's one of these big flagship programs they do, and that tends to happen with these. And it's a really hard thing to make. So it's now supposed to launch in mid to late 2019. And we hope that everything works because unlike the Hubble, it's not reachable by anything. It can't be serviced. It's going to be out at what they call Lagrange points, which are these places where items can stay more or less in a stable orbit way out between the Earth and the Moon or other areas beyond the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a big sun shield that has to be pointed towards the sun continuously because it's an infrared telescope. So it's very complicated. But it's 8 feet across. This mirror, made of many segments, is 8 feet across. So it's about 2.5 times, 3 times the size of the Hubble. So it's a big, big deal,
yeah,
and it's
wow.
just going to change the way we see the universe in ways we can't even imagine.
So mid to late 2019 is tentatively?
That's the latest, yeah. And that could slip if they have a problem. These things are complicated, and it wouldn't take much. It's really, when you start listening to these guys talk about how they make these beryllium mirror segments and how they're coated and how they've got to articulate and how this shield, this kind of diamond-shaped sun shield and multi-layers has to come out behind it to shade it from the sun and so forth. I mean, it made my part sort of jump up, and that's just me as a civilian looking at it. I can't imagine working on it and thinking, God, if my part's the one that goes bad, I'm
gonna have oh man, yeah.
Imagine?
Yeah, well, that'd be terrible. So, okay. Thanks for answering that for our listener.
Sure.
And I want to mention here that 3 days ago marked a pretty important anniversary in the space program because on February 20th, 1962, tell everybody what happened.
John Glenn went into orbit. Finally, we caught up with the Russians, sort of. So the space race had just begun, and America was behind. The Russians had bigger rockets. They had more developed capsules, at least we thought so. And while we were still testing ours with chimpanzees because the doctors were terrified that hearts would stop beating and people wouldn't be able to breathe or swallow in weightlessness and a lot of horror around that, the Russians just crammed Yuri Gagarin into their Vostok capsule and said, good luck, we hope you make it back. And off he went. So on April 12th, 1961,
right.
his capsule flew. And we didn't know it at the time, but he actually didn't ride it all the way back. There was an ejection seat. So there was a little bit of funny business there. It wasn't really quite ready for prime time. Alan Shepard flew a few weeks after that on May 5th, but that was just a suborbital 15-minute flight on a rocket that didn't have a whole lot more thrust than the X-15 did. It was basically kind of a reskinned V-2 rocket from the Germans. And then finally, Glenn flew on February 20th, 1962, and that was three orbits. And it went pretty well, but he did have to come down early because they got a, as you probably remember seeing the right stuff, a light jumped on
right.
on the console down the control room saying, hey, the heat shield's loose, and if that slides off while he's reentering, bye-bye, John Glenn.
Yeah.
Get a bucket of cinders back.
Yeah.
So they left the retro rocket pack on, and it's the only time they've ever done that, but it all worked out well, and that was it for his NASA career. He left shortly thereafter to go into politics.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you mentioned the right stuff. That's one of my favorite sequences in the entire movie. It's so beautifully done with the Australian outback and the fireflies, and then how the scene ends. Like ends so abruptly, and then you get the parade. It's one of my favorite sequences in the entire movie. It's so suspenseful and at times beautiful. Talk a little bit about the fireflies. What was that all about?
Well, nobody's absolutely certain, but it's pretty well documented. They think that it was ice crystals, because what else would it be? You know, and he was kind of flipping out a little bit. If you listen to his downlink, I mean, he's not yelling or anything. He's saying, "Woo, look at these things. They're wild. I don't know what they are." I mean, Ed Harris did a pretty good job of recreating it, I think.
Yeah.
But it was odd, because he suddenly saw this cloud of little yellowish white crystals out there, or something that was reflecting and refracting light like a crystal. So they think it was ice, but I'm not sure we'll ever be entirely certain.
Yeah. But anyway, that scene, just so such a classic.
It was, and it was one of the most accurate scenes, too, because that movie took a lot of liberties.
It did?
Oh, yeah.
Now, do you...
Some of the incidents are kind of banged up a bit, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, I don't want to know about that, Rod, because I adore that movie, and I don't want to...
It's perfect. Just like Gravity.
All right, thanks. Okay, so really quickly, I want to touch on this story about Vacations in Orbit. Bigelow Aerospace has built this inflatable space station?
Yeah, now, Robert Bigelow made his fortune on the budget in chain, so he's a hotel guy, and he decided... about 12 years ago, I guess, they said, I'm going to build hotels in space. So NASA had been experimenting for years with these inflatable modules, and he took that design and improved it. So he's flying a test version of it, a small test version, on the space station now, and it's holding air. They check it every couple of weeks and go in there and take readings and temperature readings and stuff, and it seems to be doing fine. So it looks like it's ready to fly. So his full-size ones are called B-330s. They're 12,000 cubic feet, which, at least by my calculations, if I got it right, is about the same volume as 10 20-foot cargo containers, so they're big. So he formed a sub-company to try and get these things up in the next couple of years and start leasing them out for research purposes and perhaps eventually tourism. And I think part of this move, it's been in the works for a while, but I think what finally prompted him to pull the trigger on it was Trump announcing through his new memorandum that we're going to defund the space station in 2025, and that'll probably be the end of that. So what can't happen up there can happen in one of these expandable modules. And they're also talking about sending them out by the moon. So they could become sort of the de facto go-to thing for orbital science pretty soon.
What do they do with them now? Do they store things in them?
Well, there's only one in space right now.
Okay.
On the station, just being tested.
It's just being tested.
The rest of them are on the ground. They haven't flown yet. Yeah.
Okay.
But they're pretty sure that they're going to work. And interestingly, they're fabric layers, but they actually stop certain kinds of radiation better than metal does.
Wow.
So they seem to be a very good way to go. Just don't spring a leak.
Okay, there you go. That's Bigelow Aerospace doing some work in that department. Rod, always a pleasure. An exciting time to talk to you. I was so glad to hear what you thought of the Falcon Heavy and get your response to it, because it was such an amazing thing.
You got it, brother.
All right. Take care, Rod. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
See you later.
Okay, take care.
Okay, there you go. Rod Pyle, everybody. He's the best. Space expert and great author. Tons of books, all recommended. We have a link on our Facebook page, and you can also check out pylebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. All right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up right after this.